the conversation, and then Indira and Sergey, I will turn over the discussion to them, the conversation to them. So I'm going to start with by saying a few things about the relationship between gender and poverty. And in a sense, as I keep reminding us, ourselves, myself included, poverty is about everything we do. And everything we do is about poverty at the end of the day. So it's not an isolatable, separate topic, just like gender is not a topic that we can isolate from the rest of economic theory. So let me say a few things about following from Sanjay's presentation and the discussion this morning. Let me say a few things. It is very, I had made the argument in the morning that poverty is a social relation and it's a power relation. And I had also said that it is something that is reproduced and it is the result of intersecting inequalities and power relations in the world economy, in national economies, and indeed in households. Now, let's sort of think about the relationship between gender and poverty. And the first time that that poverty, the idea that poverty is not gender neutral, is an idea that became really sort of popular in the late 70s and in the 80s. And at that time, people started talking about feminization of poverty. So I'm going to start with a question again. What do people think when they hear the expression feminization of poverty? Can I have a few people to volunteer their thoughts on that?
Again?
The question is, what comes to your mind when you hear the expression feminization of poverty? I mean, is there something that comes to your mind, an image, an idea, a feeling, a thought, whatever? Yes. It's like I'm doing one of those psychological tests, you know. it's not a psychological test.
Yes, when you talk of feminization of poverty, what comes to my mind straight away is, well, you may have a community or a household where there is a man and a woman. Mm-hmm. It may be a poor household. But then, of the two, the man could be a little better off than the woman. So the question that comes to my mind is, how comes that these two people are living in the same household, but then the woman is much poorer than the man? That's what I imagine.
Right. Terrific. Okay. I don't have to do the rest of my presentations. You said it all. Thank you, John. any other ideas that you would like to share with us? Anybody else? It's the day for me to pick on men from Africa.
I knew it will come. Yeah. Okay. Feminization of poverty. Now, before I talk about feminization of poverty, let me talk about feminization of HIV/AIDS. Now, because the concept of feminization, in my opinion, has something to do with distribution. When you take HIV/AIDS infection rate and you look at it across ages and across sex, then you will see at every ages, women are more infected than men. And this is true at the national level, but it's also true at the regional level. And even if you ventilate the data by socioeconomic group, you will also see that women at every age level range, they are actually more infected than men. Then you can really say there is feminization of poverty, of HIV/AIDS, which means it's really getting through into the feminine population much more deeper than for a group of feminine people. So feminization of poverty will be that women are becoming or are more poorer than men, but you have to look it across region, you have to look at it across ages. And then the picture will be more robust. If you take at the national level and you just say, okay, female are more poorer than male, then you lose something in the picture, you lose something in the story. That's what I can say about feminism.
John talked about the household, that we could think of a household which would be classified as poor, right? This is a household. Can I do this? Can I erase the slide? Okay. So we have these households. Let's say this is our national poverty line or international. So the household below this are the ones that we count, and we take the ratio of the population below the poverty line to the total population, and that's our head count ratio, and that's the incidence of poverty. And so we get it. We take a household, but then we have to unpack the household, because when we do poverty calculations, generally the unit of analysis is this thing called the household. But again, not everyone in a household is created equal. So we always have to unpack this household. But because the unit of analysis is the household, right? Calculations are made on the assumption, based on the assumption that distribution within the household, and Sanjay referred to that, that distribution within the household is equal. We do not see the differences in gender, by gender, within households, or by sex within households. So your example of saying, I can think of a household that is poor, that is under this poverty line, right, as measured by the concept of income poverty or consumption poverty. But then, even among households that are classified as poor, some people can be poorer than others. Okay, so that is what comes to John's mind when he says, I am thinking about this, and that is one meaning of feminization of poverty, because in the literature, feminization of poverty is used in many, many different ways, and this is one of the meanings in which it is used. Now, Nohun talked about feminization of HIV/AIDS, and he said, we should actually, when we're talking about feminization of HIV/AIDS, but also HIV/AIDS, but it can be in the income sense, right, that we should break categories down by class and age, and then we should look at the incidence of HIV/AIDS in each income category, in each income class. And if we are talking about not just income or consumption-based concepts of poverty, but if we are talking about capabilities, capability poverty, which is closer to the concept of human poverty as put forth in the human development reports, having HIV/AIDS is what? Well, very often, if you have HIV/AIDS, and if you are living in a country that does not have sufficient resources to devote to health care of people, and especially if you're in a household that is below the poverty line, what is HIV/AIDS likely to do to you? It is likely to cut your life short. Even though, now, Of course, you know, death is a condition of life, like we're all going to die one day. That is the condition of life. It's death. It's a condition of life. But here we're talking about lives that could be saved. Lives that could be saved only if we had the... Or could be made longer only if we had the resources or we had the... we have the 10 minutes passed, right? We used 10 minutes. Okay, not we have 10 minutes to go. Okay. So lives that are cut short unnecessarily, right? So in that sense, we could be talking about capability poverty if we're talking about people inflicted with HIV/AIDS. And he's saying that we should look at people, dividing them across different classes, ages, and so on. And he's saying that when we do that, when we don't just look at the aggregate numbers, but when we actually break things down, we also see that a pattern, that there are higher number of people or number of women compared to men who are inflicted with HIV/AIDS. So in that sense, he's making that distinction. And in terms of the poverty, feminization of poverty, to link that back to feminization of poverty, the second meaning of feminization of poverty has been to say that there are women living under poverty, women, you know, living under poverty, the numbers of women living under poverty are larger than the numbers of men living under poverty. So that is to say, the incidence of poverty among the female population is higher than the incidence of poverty among the male population. So this is the second way in which the concept of feminization of poverty has been used. That is, the incidence of poverty among women is higher compared to men, just like the HIV/AIDS examples that Nohun gave us. So this is the second meaning. The first meaning is women are poorer than men, even when they live in the which are classified as poor according to the consumption or income definitions of poverty, right? When we say income definition of poverty, as Sanjay talked about it this morning as well, it is just the kind of poverty that corresponds to a shortfall in consumption for which you calculate an income equivalent, right? It is about shortfall in consumption, right? Is it clear, these two definitions? Right, okay. And then there is a third way in which this is discussed, and I'm hoping somebody will read my mind and give us an example about that. Does this bring anything else to your mind, the concept of feminization of poverty? The words, the feminization of poverty. One is that the incidence of poverty is higher among women compared to men. The other one is even within the same household, women can be poorer than men because of the unequal distribution within households. And what is the third sense in which it might be used?
What does it bring to your mind? That I think sometimes women tend to be concentrated in low-wage occupations in comparison to men that keep them at a certain level of poverty, and it also and the cycle of intergenerational poverty is then more likely.
Okay, and Heather is saying
the institutionalization of poverty among women versus just among people.
As to why women are experiencing this poverty in ways that are institutionalized.
Well, for me, it seems as well that it is like a way to say that always women bring with them poverty, because they are just talking about that even in HIV/AIDS, it is more HIV, it's more in like among women than among men. This is what like it seems to me. I don't know. I said it's like that, it like reflects that the common sense that women bring poverty with them, or like where is woman, there is poverty. I don't know.
Where there is women, there is poverty. Or women bring poverty with them. That reminds me a kind of a slogan that was used, that poverty has a woman's face, that used to be very commonly, it was a common thing. And exactly. But it was a very political statement, I will tell you. And it was all wrapped up in a very political number, the 70% number. This was a very political number. It was a wrong number, but it was a very political number.
To add something to reprecise what I was saying. What I was saying is the distributional pattern, the way actually women which are in poverty, the distribution is in the country, give a much more stronger picture of feminization than just looking at the rate of female being poorer than male at the national level. The distribution across region, the distribution across age group give a picture that show the phenomenon in a much more stronger way. And the analogy I was making is you have the same pattern with HIV AIDS infection rate. Then you will see across ages, in terms of distribution, it's all the time that women are poorer than men. If you have it at the national level and you put it down, and then it is only in one region of your country that women are poorer than men, people are not really talking about feminization of poverty. But if you have it on a consistent pattern, then the picture is much more stronger, and this is something very, very important, and nobody can deny it.
We keep saying the poverty is multidimensional. It has to do with capabilities, and there's a lot of discussion about that. It's not just about income. There is another dimension of poverty which is also very much linked to, or it's clearer to see this in the case of societies where there is widespread HIV/AIDS, and this is time poverty. But Indra will speak about time poverty, but we need to speak about time poverty as well. And this is where, when we talk about time poverty, gender makes a huge difference. Time poverty is a very, very gendered concept of poverty. And why? Because, as we know, women work many, many longer hours than men do. So there is also something called time poverty. But Indira and Sergi, they will also join the discussion, to the conversation. So this is very, very important, and particularly in the case of HIV/AIDS, this can be because they're the ones who are the caregivers. Not only do they have a higher incidence of contracting HIV/AIDS, but they're also the ones who are the caregivers. So one has to look at, again, poverty, not as the poverty of the individual person or what that person is lacking and so on, but one has to see it and always situate it in the larger picture. And that's one of the things that I was arguing this morning, that we have to put it in the context of the macroeconomy, the whole, as I keep saying, right? Not see it as individual attributes of an individual. Now, I think one of the things that people also said is that this is, besides the institutionalization, one of the ways in which the feminization of poverty is used is, initially it was also used to say that the incidence of poverty among women was becoming higher over time, over time compared to men. So the proportion of women living under poverty was increasing over time. So that was one of the senses in which not only at any point in time, but this was actually getting worse. So this was also one meaning of the notion concept of feminization of poverty. Now, whether the incidence is actually higher or not is a question and an issue that has been debated. But regardless of whether the incidence is actually higher or not of poverty, when we think about poverty, we need to think about also some another concept called vulnerability. 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 We have to think about poverty always together with the concept of power, vulnerability. And this, again, is very, very important, especially if we're trying to understand gender differences among different gender differences in poverty and the differences in experiences of poverty. Because whether you believe or you think that incidence of poverty is higher among women or not, one of the things that we really do know is that poverty is experienced very differently among men and women, even living in the same household, living in the same community, same village, same urban area, same inner city, and so on. The experience of poverty is very, very different. There's big differences between men and women. Women's poverty in particular is more severe. When we say severe, we're not just using just kind of an adjective, but in poverty analysis and measurements of poverty and so on, there is the concept of incidence of poverty, there is the concept of severity of poverty, and the depth of poverty. And there are different measurements of this. We are not going into these discussions, but there are papers on this in the readings that you can, if you want to look, you know, if you want to learn more about them, what is severity of poverty, what is depth of poverty, and how do we measure this as distinct from incidence of poverty. Women's poverty is really more severe and deeper, and that means that it is harder for women to get out of poverty compared to men. And why is that? Because principally because of the kinds of things that we have been talking about for the last whatever days, and what we talked about this morning, that they don't have the kinds of assets that men have, using the notion of assets in a more broad sense, and even when they do have assets, they are not able to exercise control over those assets to the degree that, in the ways in which men can. So that is why it is harder for women to get out of poverty compared to men. And that brings me, again, I was saying that we should talk about poverty and vulnerability. Vulnerability is what? What is vulnerability? Is that just an adjective? No, it's not. It's a technical term. What is vulnerability? And of course, this has been relevant concept all along in our discussions. What is vulnerability? Technically, it is the risk of. Yeah. What's that? Yes, I know. I was going to say, if you can't answer this question, we are not going to give you a diploma. Because you were sleeping through my dear friend Serge's presentation. And if you do that, you don't get a diploma. No, vulnerability, because Sergi talked about vulnerability, risk, and okay, it is the technically the definition is the risk of falling into poverty. It is based on a concept of a poverty line, right? So it is an income poverty concept. It is based on that. It is not a broader concept of poverty, but nonetheless, it is the risk of falling into poverty. So, from the perspective of women who are not living under poverty, in conditions of poverty, the vulnerability is always higher. So we focused on the differences between men and women in households that are below the poverty line, but we can also draw another picture of a house above the poverty line, right? And everyone has some risk of falling below the poverty line. In the case of Bill Gates, this is very, very close to zero, but it's still, you know, possible, but it's very, very close to zero, I can assure you. But there are lots of people who live just above the poverty line. Now, one of the things that determines who or how many people fall below the poverty line is the severity and brutality of a macroeconomic crisis, right? When you have a macroeconomic crisis, a lot of people actually fall below the poverty line because they lose their jobs, their livelihoods, or their incomes are reduced, and so on and so forth. So it makes a big difference when you are measuring incidence of poverty. This is why you just don't want to measure what percent of the population is below the poverty line. You actually want to know how many households are close to the line, or they are way below the line, or how many are just above the line. Right? Or how many are just away from the line? Because the ones who are just above the line, right, are also have a higher risk of falling into poverty through economic crises and so on. And those kinds of households have higher yes, I know. Yeah, I know, I know. Now I'm going to play another trick on you, because I thought you were maybe playing a trick on me, but only time. But I am going to yield my time from the roundtable panel discussion on indicators. I am going to yield my time from the panel to myself. See, as economists, we know money is fungible, but it turns out time is fungible too. Yes. Okay. So the so it's very important to know how many households are actually just above the line, and because those are the people whose vulnerability or the risk of falling into poverty are going to be highest. So Bill Gates is going to be way up there. He's not going to be near the poverty line. But so those people, when we are looking at incidence of poverty, simple plain measurement of incidence of poverty, we are not sort of worrying about these people that are just above the poverty line. But through macroeconomic crises and other calamities, they can very easily move below the poverty line. And in fact, there are many people, many such households, who sort of fall and then recover, right? So they are not always on one side of the line or something like that. And there are those then, there are also chronically poor. So we also have a concept called chronic poverty. Those are the people who are really very much at the bottom of the distribution. And for them, it is very hard to get even to the line. So these are chronically poor people. And the people who are going above and below the line, the households, those we call what? What kind of poverty is that? It's not chronic. It's called transitory poverty. Okay. So now, going back to our discussion of gender and poverty and why we cannot ever talk about poverty by itself, but we always have to talk about poverty and vulnerability, the point is that there are also lots of people who are vulnerable to poverty. It's not just the incidence, but the vulnerability that is very important. And when we are looking at poverty, we can make with certainty the following statement. Whether the incidence of poverty among women is higher compared to men or not, we do know women are more vulnerable to poverty. Why? Perché? D'accord.
I think you have the whole notion of marginalization and social exclusion, which create those vulnerabilities, and they're based on various inequalities in accessing capabilities or opportunities or violations of women's human rights. Yes.
And also, women's economic well-being is often depends on their relationships within the household, right? So if women tend to concentrate, do more of unpaid work, it is not that they are not doing work, they are, and they're doing incredibly valuable work, as we all know. But through the changes in their life cycle, This is the kind of thing that makes them exactly more vulnerable to poverty. Because in the case of they become, let's say, widows, they say their husbands die, they have done all this work, but they don't have the... Yes, because women are always more dependent on men rather than the other way around. In a monetized economy where women are doing more of the unpaid work, women are always going to be more vulnerable because the society does not recognize the value of unpaid work or give you any kind of compensation for it, and so on. In old age, what is likely to happen? You know, women who become widows and so on are likely to become, compared to men, are likely to become more poor, right? So this is also depends on the life cycle, what you were saying about different age groups. What happens to women if there is a case of, let's say, divorce? What happens to women versus what happens to men?
Well, in the case of divorce, what can happen is, it can be similar what can happen in the case of when husband dies, but moreover, it's the how divorce is perceived in a particular society and whether or not women have access or ownership of property, etc. But I think the twofold thing that you just described, one from the perspective of women not being able to market their labor, and then the other part which we just talked about, but the something that Sanjay was talking about earlier in terms of just definition of the poverty, whereby women's needs are not necessarily considered to be different within that poverty line. I think that then describes how much deeper they can be in the poverty, and therefore not being able to get out, and therefore which is even worse in the cases of divorce and death of husbands.
Yes. So desertion of families by the male breadwinner bias. Again, the male breadwinner model bias ideology that we have signifies this division of labor between men and women is the very thing that also makes women much more vulnerable economically compared to men. So it can be either desertion of the family by the male breadwinner or death of the male breadwinner or divorce. In fact, a very typical standard finding that we have in the literature is that in the aftermath of divorce, women and children, because usually children tend to stay with their mothers, women and children suffer a relative impoverishment, and at the same time the standard of living of men who have, you know, gotten divorced from the same woman goes up. So the standard of living of children goes down, and in many cases this means impoverishment, even in absolute terms, in terms of falling below the poverty line, whereas for the men it would mean a higher standard of living. This is true. This is, for example, so in the United States and in many, many other countries, this is also the case as a generalized kind of pattern. Of course, this will depend on the laws and so on and so forth, but this is a general kind of finding. Yes.
No, Niloufer, I would like to ask you a little bit, because I have a little problem with with the word which it means vulnerability, because I associate vulnerability with a situation or a context, not with people. So, because I think that if you were saying like women are vulnerable, we are just excluding that the idea of the women, we are just an economic agents also. And for me, the vulnerability, when I'm talking, for example, I'm thinking all the time about, it's not just because I'm a woman per se, it's because I'm exposed to a situation that makes this risk of falling off poverty. It means like me in Guatemala, it's not because of I'm a woman, I'm walking in the streets, I'm vulnerable because, yes, I'm a woman, but because of situation that creates this, not if I was in Barcelona.
Yes, of course, but also womanhood or being a woman is not a biological thing in the way that we are talking about. It is there's a social construction of womanhood, and I mean we have been talking about this, right? So if I am vulnerable as a woman walking in the street, it is not because I am biologically, I have the sort of genes I have, but it is because there's a lot of violence which is particularly directed against women, and it is the situation, but it is a social, of course it's a social thing, and of course it is the situation. So when I say vulnerable, it is not, absolutely not, the psychological, emotional state of women versus men, they are more fragile, it has nothing to do with... Right. Vulnerability is not an attribute of the individual person. Vulnerability is technically, in this way, this is why I say, what is the definition? What did Sergi, you know, how did Sergi discuss it? It is not an attribute of the individual, or the fragility or the inability or incapability of the person. No. But neither is poverty. I mean, that's why we spent a lot of time this morning talking about poverty is not about the poor people. It's about all the society, right? It is a relation. It is a social relation, right? So, and vulnerability is like, exactly like that, right? It is not an attribute of the individual. But there are groups of people who will have higher risks of falling into poverty because of where they are in the social relations of power, gender-based, you know, race-based, etc., right? That's where the root cause of the vulnerability is. So it is a social phenomenon, not the attribute of the individual, and Simrit is raising.
As inherently vulnerable, like you were saying, poverty, yes, as an individual attribute.
Yes.
That's another way in which poverty gets feminized.
Yes, yes.
One would want to resist.
Yes. I see what you want. I mean, yes, I think I myself at some point had a great problem with the word vulnerability because of the confusion, not in my mind, but in the minds of, you know, folks sitting in the UN and so on. But I am using it in terms of the risk.
Yeah. Maybe in Peru there are some situations like confused with a sort of weakness, because women need more protection. For example, when walk alone in the street, they need to protect special protection, especially for a man. I think that in America, Latin America, is more associated to a sort of weakness, no? That is inherent to women, the kind of weakness, no? more like vulnerable.
This is almost like exactly like blaming the victim, right? This is blaming the victim. I mean, women get raped for walking at night, and then it is like their problem. They're the ones who are blamed. And of course, we should be fiercely opposing that. So that is also the same kind of idea. And in 1 minute, I am going to go into the relationship between violence and poverty, which is so crucial in the case of women.
Thank you, Annie Pflüger. Well, I wanted to tell you, for me, I think one of the basic causes for the feminization of the women are the less access to education, and the age that they become mother. No, as younger they become mother, they are less access, not to the development, because they are less time to study, to work. No. And that's it. It's what I can see, especially in the rural areas of Peru.
I would just like to add, it just occurred to me that one way to think of this relationship between the definition of vulnerability that we often think of and actually the strengths that women exhibit is that during the times of crisis, women are the ones who take on the negative consequences, often disproportionately. That is what makes them vulnerable. But in fact, they are the ones who are the strong ones who come out and bring often the families and the survival of the families depends on them. So they are vulnerable in a sense that they are the bearers of the consequence of responsibilities, but then they are the ones who pull the family up. For instance, in the case of Georgia, this is one of the things, and I know in the case of many developing countries, I mean, when we talk about unpaid work, that's really what we are talking about, right? But then more so, I mean, in the case of Georgia, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it was the women who started, who were the creative ones in most cases, and who started baking goods and, I don't know, doing things that they never thought they would have to do. So I think this is one way, a good way to kind of separate vulnerability in a sense of being affected by it. But then they are actually, they were very strong and they are very strong in dealing with it.
You don't need a crisis, but we have to beat them over the head. with our ideas. we have to beat them over the head with our ideas, that's why. And I was exactly going to say what Tamar said. And in fact, we even had a little discussion about that this morning in the context of Georgia, right? What did men do in Russia after the shock therapy? They drank, they committed suicide. And in fact, life expectancy of men in Russia declined, right? So even from a human poverty measurement point of view, this is, right? But then you see there, what do you see there? That if you measure this in a kind of sort of mindless measurement way, what do you see? Ah, men in Russia are poorer by human poverty measurements. That's what you would conclude, right? Because you would say that the more men's are lives are getting cut short because either because they are drinking or whatever, or they're committing suicide and so on. So you would say the incidence of poverty in Russia, in the post-Soviet Union, among men, would be measured as being higher than poverty of women, right? But why are we, that's a perverse measurement. I always talk about also perverse measurements, but that is a perverse way of measuring things. So if you don't understand the process through which you got these numbers, right, in that society, then you're going to make the conclusion that men are poorer. But it's precisely because women are so strong and flexible in their responses, because they behave really, really differently, because they behave really, really differently compared to men in conditions of crisis, whether these are macroeconomic crises or personal crises or household community level crises, they are the ones who bear the burden of those adjustments most of the time. So women in Russia went, and because they were the ones also who were responsible for the children, in some sense women don't have the choice to commit suicide. They cannot exit, check out, because they're responsible for the children, whereas men can do these other kinds of things, right? We drink, commit suicide, etc., etc., but the woman doesn't have the choice, if you will, quote-unquote, doesn't have that choice. She has to survive because she has to reproduce her children. She has to make sure that her children live. So women do all kinds of things. They are very flexible, but men, their masculinity is such that it doesn't allow them to do some kind of job which appears to be beneath sort of what they had been doing before, and therefore for them these kinds of behavior may be even more preferable. So it is precisely that women are stronger through these periods of crisis that they are able to survive, but in the technical sense, they are more vulnerable. I will make one last point, and then I will turn it over to Indira and Sergi.
Yes. I think you have to give these poor men here a break.
Which poor men? I don't know about that. They appear to be okay. They appear okay.
No, I don't think that's
Horshid
is not okay.
I've been told Horshid is not okay. Sorry, it's not my opinion. Okay. Yes, of course. When we're talking about men and women, it doesn't mean that all women are breaking their backs to make sure that their children survive, and it doesn't mean the opposite. These are sort of generalities we are talking about. We are talking about stylized facts, so to speak, okay, regularities of behavior. We're not talking about each and every individual, of course. Absolutely not. Is it? We have to turn the mic on.
No, this is completely out of place, and it's a rude joke for the middle of the afternoon. Okay? It's a riddle. What's the similarity between a Bengali man and a sperm? Sorry, guys. Any idea? Since people keep getting asked questions out here, right? What's the similarity between a Bengali man and a sperm? One in a million works.
Okay, I am, you know, among other things, I am a sort of a adopted Bengali in a Bengali chauvinist, so you're telling this for my benefit, I know. I am, because I am a Bengali chauvinist, adopted Bengali. Okay. I am now going to talk about one other thing very quickly. The topic is vast. It is about the relationship between, again, violence and poverty. This morning I said poverty itself is violence. It is structural violence. Sometimes it is easy to see it, but a lot of times it is not, and poverty kills. In the case of women and men, there are, though, some differences in terms of the relationship between poverty and violence, and these are very, very interconnected. I talk a lot about, and I've been making continual references to, how labor is extracted from people, even in very polite capitalist societies, very civilized-looking, advanced, quote-unquote, advanced capitalist societies. There is always an extraction of labor in paid and as well as in paid forms, particularly from women. And in paid forms, I would call it the differential that corresponds to discrimination, because we can also think of discriminatory wages as forms of super exploitation, right? Compared to the race of exploitation of men. So I would call that labor extraction or super exploitation. Now, however, women, the violence of poverty and women's poverty is connected to violence in many different ways. There's a finding, and this is in the United States, for example, but you will find very similar stories everywhere in the world. A lot of women who escape from domestic violence go into shelters. They take their children if they can, and they go to women's shelters. Women's shelters now in many, many countries. But it turns out a lot of them, and this is actually research of Randy Alberta at the UMass Boston, Alberta, at UMass Boston. It turns out, though, they cannot then go, a lot of them cannot go and get jobs because they may be stalked, they are too scared to go out. So because they are the threat of violence can be so brutal on women that they cannot actually go out and work, even though they want to work, they have the capability to work. It is the fear of violence that really disables them from working. So violence is something very important in connecting to gender understanding of psychological violence. And there is also a lot of psychological violence. I would also like to point to the fact that a lot of women, because of their fear of falling into poverty in the income sense of poverty, are too scared to get divorced, to break relationships that are abusive, because they don't have the alternative. In economic terms, they are going to be so impoverished. Remember, I just told you that after divorce, one pattern that we observe, at least in some countries, is that women and children become impoverished in either relative and very often in an absolute sense, but definitely in a relative sense compared to the men. But also that fear of falling into poverty forces women to stay in households, in relationships that are, or HIV AIDS, so there is a very, very many ways in which gendered patterns of poverty have to be examined, and the relationship to violence or the threat of violence, which is psychological violence, is very, very important in understanding. And all of those are very interconnected, you know, economics of falling into poverty, but also this is always connected to violence, violation of rights, as well as to not only to physical violence, but also to psychological violence. And this is why, this is the sense in which when we say women's poverty is more brutal and more severe, and that it is harder for women to get out of poverty, these are the senses in which, and these are the reasons for which I am saying that it is harder for women. It is not because they are not capable of working to earn money. It is not because they are not willing to do that. Because what we see is that in context of economic crisis, they respond so differently compared to men. So we have heard the examples from the former Soviet Union countries. But then in other kinds of contexts, there can be a lot of other things that can really make it much harder for them to get out of poverty, despite the fact that they make really, really extraordinary efforts to do so. They may not be, but the bars may be so high that they may not be able to get out of poverty as easily as men. I am going to stop now, and I'm going to turn over to. I'm going to say one thing. The recognition of the fact that there's some kind of connection between gender and poverty, as I said, was old. And in the mid-80s, people started talking about the fact that 70% of the world's poor people are women. This 70% was a kind of invented number, but it was very important politically because everybody started repeating this number, and this is how people started saying women poverty has a women's face and so on. And that had kind of the impact of policymakers actually paying more attention and trying to do something specifically and focused ways about poverty of women, the recognition that it was different and higher and so forth. And there is a whole thing about how this must measure, the whole controversy about female-headed households and so on. I'm not going to get into that yet. But this was a very powerful number, And even if it was a wrong number, actually, women's poverty is really more brutal than men's. So it doesn't matter in some sense whether it is this, they are the 70% or the 51% of the poor people living in the world, of people living under poverty, because the aspect of brutality is so important, and also vulnerability in the way that I have described it. And for the longest of time, policymakers thought they had two great solutions to this when they thought they had to respond to it. And what were those two policy things, responses to poverty, particularly women's poverty? It was, on the one hand, you did what kind of finance? Microfinance. And what kind of entrepreneurship? Microenterprise, microfinance. Those twin things, and it was thought that this was going to solve the problem. And of course, the problem cannot be solved whether you are for or against microfinance. The problem cannot be solved in that way, because the problem is something that permeates all the economic relations and the whole society and the macroeconomy. It has to be solved from a macroeconomic point of view. So now, having said that, and of course, many of us have been contesting this, and this is one of the reasons why we really, really, really try to sort of do feminist macroeconomics in the sense that we have been describing it, because women's poverty, women's economic problems, they are always relegated to this micro level. And one of the things that we've been trying to do as a group of people, as GEM people, is to make the point that these are not microfinance, micro entrepreneurship, micro this, micro level issues. These have to be looked at from the macroeconomic perspective, and this is what we do. And now I am going to turn over the mic to Indira. Or